and Dr. Anthony Lysowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Leuschner. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to the number 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Willie Levinson, the founder of Human Access Project, to talk about some upcoming events on the Willamette River, the Cathedral Park River Fest, and Human Access Project Swim Week. Welcome to the show, Willie.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me today. So your organization is dedicated to improving public access to the Willamette River. Can you tell me a little bit about how that kind of work got started?
Sure. So the mission of Human Access Project is actually a little more broad. Our mission is to transform Portland's relationship with the Willamette River. So a lot of the ways we get people connected with the Willamette has been our work to improve access to the river with trails and improving riverside areas, such as, over the last 14 years, we've removed over 350 tons of concrete and rubble from river edge spaces, making these spaces more beachy and attractive for people to want to get to the water's edge, and it also improves shallow water habitat for salmon. But the origins of a Human Access Project was that in 2011, the city of Portland completed a $1.44 billion project called the Big Pipe. It used to be that after only a tenth of an inch of rain, raw sewage would flow directly into the Willamette River. So a tenth of an inch of rain is not a very big threshold in rainy Portland. And as a result, we would have sewage overflows happening 50 to 100 times a year. And when they happened, they would be measured in days and weeks at a time. So after the Big Pipe, the city made a decision not to 100% contain the sewage because apparently it would have doubled the cost. And it is already the city's largest civic investment in our history at $1.44 billion. But as a result, today, after the Big Pipe, we typically only have 4 to 5 combined sewage overflows a year. There's never been one in the summertime since 2011. And when it happens now in the winter, it's typically measured in minutes and hours. And it's 80% stormwater and 20% sewage when it happens. So no apologies for the sewage overflows when they happen. But with that information, and the information that because we've controlled this problem in the summertime, and all the other work that's been done by the city, other nonprofit organizations over the last 50, 60 years, I discovered the Willamette was safer swimming.
One of the things I did want to ask was, what are some of the past projects that Human Access Project has done, now that you're talking about the history since the Big Pipe started this transformation of the Willamette River?
The very first thing we did was an event called the Big Float. And the Big Float was actually a tribute to the Big Pipe and a spin on the name. And the idea was that the data said scientifically that it was safe to get into the river, but the culture was so indoctrinated with the idea that if you touch the Willamette, it will, make your skin flake off, you'll grow horns, or everybody seemed to have a pocket joke about the Willamette, and that was really perpetuating this disconnect with the river. So my thought was, well, if we can set up a really accessible way to get into the river and do it in a big, fun, campy way, then people might not think so much about what they've been told in the past and give the Willamette another shot. So the big float we wound up doing for 10 years, we brought over 25,000 people to the river, and that really became a platform for our activism. From there, we started chipping away at river edge spaces. So started doing work at Audrey McCall Beach. This is south of the Hawthorne Bridge, between the Hawthorne Bridge and OMSI. It was cluttered with concrete chunks. So I had to get permission from 8 separate agencies to remove concrete chunks with the stipulation that we could not use heavy mechanized equipment because there was a cleanup going on at the site and they were really sensitive about disturbing what was there. So we partnered with inmate work crews and volunteers, and over 4 years, we manually removed 200 tons of concrete, Sodger McCall Beach. Then on the west side of the river, we spearheaded Portland's first recognized public beach in 100 years, Poets Beach. So kind of reversed the order. So the first beach that was officially open was Poets Beach. And what we did there was we got permission from Army Corps of Engineers, Department of State Lands, and the Parks Department to cut 2 5-foot chunks of basalt from the trail that goes to the river, then cleaned up all the riprap off the beach and put it back on the bank where it serves bank protection. Then we inscribed children's poetry about the Willamette on the rocks leading to the river and got 11 Chinook jargon words from the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. So the public, the non-Indigenous public, can learn 11 Chinook jargon words with the Chinook Wawa spelling, the English phonetic, and the English translation. Audrey McCall Beach became the second official public beach to open. And then from there, in 2022, we worked with Parks and Recreation for them to name 6 official safer swimming areas on the Willamette River, which is now on their website.
Well, I hear that there are a few events coming up this summer, one of which is Cathedral Park River Fest happening on Saturday, June 29th, related to, you know, opening up beaches and things like that. What can you tell me about this event?
Yes, this is a really exciting historic day for St. John's. Human Access Project started our work there in 2021, just coming out of the pandemic. As I've been preparing for this, I'm just looking at historical videos of volunteers wearing face masks because we're still not feeling, we're still feeling a little shy from COVID. So in 2021, we got 100 volunteers together and we removed 25 tons of concrete from the north side of the beach, which really made a big impact. Then in 2022, we got a federal grant of $300,000 to improve access to the river. So we reached out to the Parks Department and asked for ideas of what we could do in the short term with big impact with that money. And Parks said, well, you know, we're $300,000 short of replacing the Cathedral Park dock. And I said, hey, you know, if you can do it next year, you're on. So by the time we got the funds in 2023, sure enough, Parks delivered, and there is now a brand new dock in place. Swim ladders are being added in the next couple of days. And it's just a beautiful place to swim under the St. John's Bridge. The total cost of the dock was $700,000. And so we just handed the check right over to Parks. Then in 2023, we brought out 150 volunteers and we removed 125 tons of concrete from the south side of the dock. So this Cathedral Park Riverfest grand opening for the new dock is really an opportunity for Portland and particularly the St. John's community to rediscover Cathedral Park. If you haven't been, if anyone hasn't been to Cathedral Park in the last few years, it is going to look dramatically different. But I'm really just super excited to see Cathedral Park turn into a river recreation playground. The dock is just going to lure all sorts of fun activities and just be something to be proud of in St. John's.
So this event is coming up on this Saturday, and of course the new dock is there. It's starting at 2:00. What kind of things can folks expect from this event?
So yes, so at 2:00 there is going to be a free family all ages swim clinic led by Black Swimming Initiative. and you don't have to be Black or BIPOC to come. They've called themselves Black Swimming Initiative because the highest rate of drowning is among kids, and it's twice the percentage of drowning for kids of color and Black kids. So they're really day-to-day focused on the Black community and BIPOC community. For Saturday, if you're an adult and you feel shy about getting in the water, kids, this is an opportunity to learn basic swimming skills. Then at 3 o'clock, we are going to kick off our opening ceremony, which will feature synchronized swim team, mermaids with tails swimming in the water, convergence of bike riders from a Yacht Rock bike ride from Bike Loud and Bike Portland, the River Hugger swim team, which is a program of half will converge on the dock. We'll have a dance troupe and we'll have a fireboat display. Then we'll have some VIPs from our city government speak, and then live music from 4 to 8 and DJ music with DJ Carlos from 8 to 9. So it's free to the public. We're going to have free kayak rentals from Mosquito Fleet, free life jacket giveaway from Metro, food carts. It's just going to be a super fun time.
Well, I understand that Human Access Project also has a special event planned next week for July 3rd called the Four Quadrant Candidate Splash Ride. What's that event all about?
That is correct. So this event on Saturday is going to kick off the inaugural Human Access Project Swim Week. So if you follow us on Instagram and Facebook, we're going to have some pop-up events throughout the week. The two big events are going to be the Cathedral Park Riverfest and the Four Quadrant Candidate Splash Ride, which we are partnering with our friends at Bike Loud and Lloyd Eco District with. So it's going to be a bike ride that starts from all four floating quadrants. There are 32 candidates confirmed for the ride. All the bike rides are going to converge on Bike Portland's Bike Happy Hour on the Ankeny Block in Southeast. And then everybody from the bike ride and Bike Happy Hour is going to converge on Duckworth Dock to kick off Duckworth Summer Wednesdays. So Duckworth Summer Wednesdays is a program we have weekly on Wednesdays at the Duckworth Dock in partnership with Bike Loud and Lloyd Eco District. It's going to be every Wednesday through August. And what you can expect there is we have live music from DJ Carlos of Pop Cart PDX. There's a really fun phenomenon that happens where the sun, when it sets, bounces off Big Pink. So there's two sunsets that trail into the water during Duckworth Summer Wednesdays. It's like Portland Stonehenge. It's a kind of celestial, but it's really fun. And then we have diving competitions, visits from synchronized swim groups, but mostly it's just Portland's emerging dock culture. So it's a great place to get close to the water, as close as you can get to the water without being in a boat. The Duckworth Dock is surrounded by water on all three sides. And, you know, it's just a place to dip in the river when you get hot, get out, visit with your friends. But it's a very fun new Portland thing to do. Last year, we only had 6 events, but we averaged 300 people each night. So if you haven't checked out Duckworth Summer Wednesdays, definitely give that a shot. It's very close to the KBU studios.
Oh, is that so? Okay, very cool.
Yeah, so Duckworth is on the floating section of the Esplanade between the Steel and Burnside Bridges. So from KBU, I think I'd probably go down Ankeny. That's a nice bike street. And then make your way over to the entrance of the Esplanade by the Rose Quarter. And then, boom. Boom, you're there.
Giving me directions and everything. What do you hope people get out of these upcoming Human Access Project events?
Well, you know, ultimately, we're really driven by the simple words of Jacques Cousteau. People protect what they love. There's a clear nexus between recreation and stewardship. And, you know, for me, when I started my work and I heard people making jokes about the Willamette River, it was really frustrating because Portland identifies as being a really green place, and for a human being to make a joke about a river, it felt really hypocritical. But on closer examination, what the jokes represent to me is an expression of hopelessness and a way to subordinate something that's really uncomfortable. So with these events, you know, with science and with people recreating and people being able to see the Willamette as an asset, the hope is that the recreation will lead to stewardship, to awareness, to fighting for the river, to protect the river. And, you know, it's the missing leg of livability in our city. I mean, for me, one of the highest metrics of livability is being able to get on your bike, ride to the river in the summertime, and take a dip. So that's really what this represents for Human Access Project is for people who haven't swum in the Willamette, for sure, we're looking to just build a culture around people loving the river. Our vision, organizational mission, vision is just simply a city in love with its river. So, you know, in the future, the goal is that our community does feel pride around the Willamette River, loves it, and views it as a precious asset to our city.
If our listeners are interested, where can folks find out more information?
You can find out more information at humanaccessproject.com. We're on Instagram and Facebook, and you can sign up for our newsletter on the homepage of our website.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I hope that we are able to hook up for a Duckworth Summer Wednesday to take a dip. Have you taken a dip in the Willamette yourself?
I have. I usually go down to Selwood, though.
Selwood's a wonderful place to swim. Well, when you have this shift that you're on right now, this would be a perfect time to go to work in your swimsuit, wrap up, and head down to Duckworth.
You don't have to twist my arm. I like the idea.
Yeah. No, it'd be cool. I'd love to share a splash with you.
Well, Willie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you for supporting our work and for helping to amplify Duckworth Summer Wednesdays and our big summer kickoff event, Cathedral Park Riverfest. Hope you can make it there, too.
I've been speaking with Willie Levinson, the founder of the Human Access Project. HAP will be hosting Cathedral Park Riverfest from 2 to 8 p.m. on Saturday, June 29th. And next week, on July 3rd at 3:30 p.m., City Council candidates from across the four quadrants will bike and converge on the Duckworth Dock. More information on these events is online at humanaccessproject.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. While Israel certainly receives a good share of the bombs and missiles it uses in Gaza from the U.S., some commentators have pointed out that Washington is also secretly providing very advanced intelligence and artificial intelligence to target people in Gaza. James Bamford is the author of Spyfall, The Puzzle Palace, and Body of Secrets, and he recently wrote a piece for The Nation magazine called How U.S. Intelligence and an American Company Feed Israel's Killing Machine in Gaza. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg earlier this spring.
What is feeding the Israeli killing machine in terms of artificial intelligence? How's that working? Do they have their own programs to do that, or are they getting help from outside, from some companies like in the U.S.?
Both. They develop their own systems, and they get help from the U.S. One of the companies is Palantir. It's a company in Denver, and they make pretty much data mining software. A lot of it is used for targeting. They produce the most targeting software for the war in Ukraine, for the Ukrainian government. So they're very experienced in doing that. And then more recently, they've been selling their systems to the Israeli government. And what they do is they give the Israeli government the opportunity to use AI, artificial intelligence, in order to assist their targeting. So where previously targets would be picked out and debated and analyzed and then executed by humans. At this point, it's done almost instantaneously, within seconds a lot of times, by machines that have a number of failure rates. I think some of the systems that they use for targeting have up to 10% failure rate, which means 10% of the people who are killed aren't targets. Right. So there's a lot of that. Then the Israelis have their own system. One of them is called Lavender, which is used to target a lot of innocent civilians. And that's how you have so many innocent civilian deaths over there.
Is part of the argument for AI, for these type of targeting systems, is part of the argument that it makes the targeting more precise? Is that what they try to argue?
It makes the target more efficient. And in other words, if instead of going through a lot of data, that's the other issue here is data. In order to have a targeting system, you need a great deal of data, which means intelligence. Where is this person? Who is this person? What is his habits? All those kind of things. So where does he live? And they get a lot of that information from the U.S., from the National Security Agency, the NSA. So the NSA collects a great deal of intelligence, and we've had a long-term intelligence sharing agreement with the Israeli government. So the NSA supplies a lot of the data that goes into the AI machines, the targeting machines. So the AI machines take this data. Where does a person live? How long have they lived there? How many members of his family? Where is he normally on a particular day? What are his connections, if any, to Hamas? Who are his friends? Who are his contacts? So it takes all that intelligence, and instead of some analyst like me or whatever human being sitting down and trying to figure this out, is this person valid? Is this person not valid? Do you think this person would be there right now? It's all done in a matter of seconds because the AI does the analysis.
Is this the kind of system the U.S. uses when it conducts its drone attacks in various countries?
Yeah, the U.S. uses a similar system. I'm not as familiar with what systems the U.S. uses for drones, but basically it's the same kind of system, and Palantir sells their equipment to the U.S. as well as to foreign governments. So I would assume it'd be somewhat similar to that. Although you can never know. It depends on how much human input an intelligence agency or a country or a government inputs into that AI. It could be 90% AI, 80% AI, 95% AI. So you don't know unless you have the information how much of an input the human being is on this. There's better input, human input, in the U.S. system than there has been, obviously, in the Israeli system, since they kill a great number of people. A part of that also is because of their own system, like one called Lavender, which notifies the targeteer or the person manning the targets when that person is home, for example. And then they destroy the home. They bomb the home or something.
So it could be the family as well as the target, right?
That's right. So they don't really care. They just want to get the target. They know the target's home. It's easier to get him when he's sitting down in his chair at home than traveling in a car someplace. So then they the program says, okay, he's home. And then immediately they blow up the house, and you're killing numerous civilians, the spouse, the children, any kind of relatives, grandparents, aunts, uncles, whoever happens to be in the house. And these days, there's a lot of large family living in a single house because a lot of the houses have been destroyed. So that's what's adding to the enormous numbers of casualty rates, over 33,000, at least that we know of. I mean, how many are buried under the rubble?
These companies that you referred to, are they also producing robots that will go to war in place of soldiers?
Well, I don't know about Palantir. I'm only focused on their targeting software at this point, but there are numerous companies in the U.S. that are developing autonomous systems, even for jet aircraft. So there's a that's sort of the next wave, is to create this sort of autonomous warfare where the soldiers and the warriors are sitting at some console in front of a computer screen, and it's these machines that are actually doing the work, the bombing, the shooting, the killing, and so forth. So we're moving in that direction, and you can see how both in the Ukraine and also in Gaza, how it's being put into effect.
What is Unit 8200? Could you talk about that?
Unit 8200 is the Israeli equivalent of the National Security Agency, NSA. They both have the same task, which is to, using very, very sophisticated technology, to eavesdrop on communications and to store and analyze those communications. The NSA supplies a great deal of the technical information to Israel, and Unit 8200 makes use of that while they're conducting this war in Gaza. So the two work together very closely, and both of them are extremely sophisticated when it comes to eavesdropping, targeting, and anything to do with electronic surveillance.
So any opposition that you know of within the Israeli or American government to this type of warfare?
Well, it's interesting. I interviewed Edward Snowden when he first got to Moscow after he fled the U.S. with a great deal of material he had taken, you know, hundreds of thousands of documents on digital flash drives that he took from the NSA. He went to Hong Kong, and then he ended up in Moscow, and I interviewed him. I was one of the first people to interview him in Moscow. I spent about 3 days with him there. And one of the things he told me was that one of the biggest problems that he saw, or the things that offended him the most, was the fact that the U.S. was eavesdropping on Palestinians in the U.S., Palestinian citizens, Palestinian relatives, and so forth. And they were communicating to their relatives and friends back in the occupied territories. So the NSA was sending Israel this unredacted material on American citizens who happen to be Palestinian. And then the Israelis would make use of it, trying to blackmail them, bribe them, extort from them, and turn them into agents. So Snowden told me about that, and then about a year later, it was still going on. It's probably still going on now. But about a year later, there were about over 40 members of the Israeli military who were working at Unit 8200. And they became so upset at the outrageous use of that information to target and eavesdrop and extort Palestinians that they actually walked out and held press conferences. And it was a big scandal for quite a while. So, I mean, even the Israeli military people who were doing this were so offended by the outrageousness of the activity. And again, the U.S. had been the major collaborator with Unit 8200 on these activities.
So the Congress just approved once again the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. So would that cover what you're talking about? The idea that American citizens can be spied on when they talk to people in other countries?
Yes, the way it works is the NSA collects enormous amounts of information. If they want to eavesdrop on me or American citizen, they have to get a warrant from a judge to do that and show probable cause, show why I should be eavesdropped on. However, if I make a phone call to somebody overseas who's not an American citizen, they can eavesdrop. Well, they can, first of all, collect that information without a warrant because I'm speaking to somebody outside the country who's not an American citizen. And their justification is that they're attempting to collect intelligence. So theoretically, they're doing it because they're trying to collect intelligence on the person overseas. And then once that's all collected, it goes to this huge storage facility. It's a data storage facility NSA has in Utah. It's a mammoth facility. It's five times the size of the U.S. Capitol. And it can hold up to zettabytes and yottabytes, which are the two largest numbers ever created for digital storage. So it takes all that, puts it into the storage capability out in Bluffdale, Utah, and then it can stay there forever. There's no time on it.
That was author and journalist James Bamford speaking with KABU contributor David Rosenberg. You've been listening to KABU News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
Tune to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kabu.fm.
KBOO's board is recruiting directors.